Thank you very much for this nice introduction. So I'm a development economist who is doing more and more economic history, especially in Africa. And not only it's an honor to speak after Danny Roderick, but I feel that my contribution will be kind of complementary to his own, because I'm very much concerned about what he called the fundamentals of Africa. And I must say also as an introduction that I share also the kind of skepticism that he expressed with regards to the potential for industrialization in Africa, but we'll be able perhaps to come back on that issue. I'm not purely pessimistic, but skeptic. So, of course, from a development economist viewpoint, the question raised by African economies has already been summarized in the graphs that François showed us. So here's is another graph of the same flavor, taken from a paper from William Easterly, "Can the West Save Africa?" That with a figure that depicts the divergence of the African continent with respect to the rest of the developing world. And what this graph pretty well illustrates is that this kind of divergence pretty much accelerated during what has been called the last decades of development, both for Africa and Latin America as well, that were the 1980s and 1990s. So, if I take now the standpoint of an economic historian, and then taking a longer term as standpoint, here is another development indicator that is very much liked by some economic historians, that is height stature in centimeters. So it's so the graph depicts the evolution of height stature across birth cohorts. So you see that we can go back as early as the beginning of the 20th century by using military conscripts data. And it tells a story of a very, for the three first quarters of the 20th century, of a very large increase in height stature in the country of Côte d'Ivoire. So here we focus on an individual country of Africa, and the height gains that were obtained during these three first quarters of 20th century are very much comparable to, for instance, Robert Fogel's own figure for Britain or France that were achieved at the same time during the 20th century. But it's also the case that this graph tells also the story of a kind of arrested development in the last quarter of the 20th century, with something that is seldom observed with height stature evolutions, that is a regression in height stature. So you see a fall of average height stature at the end of the period. So, hence, both development economists and economic historians have been concerned with the explanation of what has been called this African dummy that can be looked at on the whole sample of African countries, but also illustrated in the individual case of Côte d'Ivoire. So, in the remainder, I would like to say a few words on what I believe to be two very important determinants of long-term African development. That is, firstly, the productivity of smallholder agriculture, and secondly, the construction of the state, and if possible, of a state able to promote development, economic development. In each case, I will describe in a nutshell the legacy of the long-term history and see how this historical analysis can shed light on present and even future evolution. And if there is time left, which I doubt, but François will tell me, I will also try to say a few words on research priorities, but perhaps we'll have time to come back on that later on. So here is a table on factorial long-term factorial intensity that I tend to to use with my students to warn them against too rapid, too quick intercontinental comparisons. So the idea is that long-term history, whether pre-colonial or colonial, has determined that Africa was for long characterized by land abundance and the relative scarcity of both the other factors of production of both labor and capital. So the low ratio of labor to land is due to the extensive nature of African agriculture that contrasts very much with the Asian agriculture, for instance, and is more similar to the indigenous agriculture of the Americas. Like in the Americas, the absence of the wheel and the associated irrigation techniques, the use of the hoe instead of the plough, the absence of writing and associated land right and cadastral information are all elements of this agricultural difference. In Holland, now, the low ratio of capital to land that could be observed, say, at the end of the colonial period can be linked with the absence of large European settlement colonization in contrast with Latin America, and of course in contrast with the exception in Africa, that is South Africa. Okay. I had two slides that illustrate and then corroborate to some extent those two important structural differences, but I will skip them for the sake of time. So I would rather like to argue about the long-standing consequences of the structural differences. So of course, according to the Echerolinian theory of international trade, these factor intensity have largely determined the international specialization of Africa in agriculture and natural resource exports. In particular, they have largely limited the emergence for a long time. The emergence of labor-intensive production. An anecdote, for instance, labor scarcity during the colonial period can explain why the failure of the attempts of developing rubber exports that were first started in Brazil, then failed and shifted to Asia, where the cost of labor was much more cheaper. Labor scarcity, but my take is that labor scarcity, and in particular land abundance, can more generally account for a large range of institutional features and that are still, from my standpoint, specific to Africa. Here I'm also following Garrett Austin, a renowned economic historian of Africa. So the great, the great anthropologist Jack Goody has, for example, argued that the features of the African agriculture have largely determined the very original family structures and inheritance rules that can be observed in Africa and make it very distinct from Europe and from the whole Eurasia, the so-called ancient world. In terms of demographic model also, I think that it can also account for the communal land use rights that are observed in Africa, and the fact that land use rights are most often in many settings allocated with respect to labor. This is also one of the this labor scarcity is also, and this very this land abundance is very much the determinant of the absence of the emergence of feudality that was also argued by Jack Goody. So it's also a determinant of a historical determinant of the fact that historically, at least during the pre-colonial period, wealth in pre-colonial African societies was mostly stemming from political control of labor and of trade rather than the holding of large amount of land. And conversely, the poverty was also, and it has been argued by the historian John Leaf, that poverty in the pre-colonial setting was mainly stemming from a lack of labor force, like, for instance, having health handicaps individually, or having being cut from networks of family networks of solidarity, than lack of access to land or being a landless peasant, because there were no landless peasant. So of course, likewise, the salience of slave and indentured labor was also very much linked with the very high value associated to the control of labor, and the Atlantic slave trades have further increased the scarcity of this labor during four centuries. So during the colonial period, as recently showed in a paper of the Journal of Economic History by Frank Emma Evan Weisenberg, the free labor that could be found in emerging colonial African cities was much more expensive than the comparable labor that could be found in Asian cities at the same time. So now let me turn a bit to the present and perhaps even to the future by looking at the evolution of this extensive agriculture of Africa. So as of today, Africa's agriculture is still very, very much extensive. It's important to recall that the African farmers were able in the past to adopt many crops from the Americas, and they have turned to very important crops like cassava, like maize and cocoa. But at the same time, it's not the case that African agricultural techniques have intensified. They still use, as of today, they still use very few inputs, almost no irrigation in many areas, few improved varieties, and they still practice in many areas slash and burn, long fallows, the hoe, and intensive use of female and child labor. I've here reported a figure drawn from the World Development Report of 2008, so the World Bank annual production that was in that year dedicated to agriculture. And I think that this figure very, very well illustrates, focusing on the post-independence, post-1960 evolutions, that the bulk of the increase in cereal production needed to feed African population was largely obtained out of an extension of land farmed, whereas in Asia, most of the expansion was obtained out of the increase of the yield, what was called the Green Revolution. Then, where do we stand today in terms of land abundance of Africa? Are we close to the point where the Malthusian constraint will be reached, and a kind of Bozerupian intensification will begin? It's very striking to see that there is a very strong disagreement on that question. If you refer to Michael Lipton, who is a very well-known specialist of smallholder agriculture in developing countries, he would say, no, there is no longer cheap, accessible, good quality land available in Africa. Whereas if you refer to a World Bank expert like Klaus Deininger, he would say, yes, there is still large amounts of abundant arable land, whereas it can be found in Africa mostly, and secondarily as well in Latin America. In a recent work, we tried to look at this issue of the Malthusian constraint by focusing on an individual example, again the case of Guyana. Using household surveys of the world, funded by the World Bank and implemented all over the two decades running from 1985 to 2005, it was a well, great effort, I must confess, given well the noise of the data, we calculated that actually the amount of land farmed across this 20 years period had more or less doubled, whereas the population of Guyana has less than doubled. So that if you compute the figures in terms of land per capita, even the land per capita ratio has increased, okay? This is largely due to the recovery of the cocoa sector. I have no time to develop. Even the increase of the land per capita is largely due to the recovery of the cocoa sector. But what I feel is most striking is that you have a doubling of land use with also, according to our calculations, little change in yields. So at the same time, you have a conquest through the clearing of the forest, a conquest of large amounts of land, and these additional large amounts of land are not characterized by lower yields. That is, it's not lower quality land. Okay. So everything is as if, in this setting, that extensive agriculture was still able to reproduce itself during these 20 years. So it's very difficult to know where the Malthusian constraint really lies, because then you need an assessment of how large the agricultural land is, okay, the total amount of land that could be farmed is, okay. So there are evaluations from the FAO, and according to the FAO figure, the agricultural land that is still available is equal to the double of the amount of land that is farmed today. So at the pace of the conquest of land that we observe today, we should reach, if the pace is maintained, we should hit the wall of the Malthusian constraint within 20 years. Okay, but of course, given climate change and the acceleration of climate change, of course, this constraint could be reached much earlier. So now let me turn to the question of the construction of the state. How many minutes? 10 minutes? No, fair enough. So I need to rush really over very large issues. Let me turn to the other question that I would like to delve into a bit, the question of the construction of the state, and also to the related and often raised question of ethnicity that seems to be considered as an unavoidable specificity of the African societies that is sometimes taken as the guilty of preventing the construction of a developmental state. So in the recent economic history literature published in the top journals, we see precisely the emergence of an argument according to which pre-colonial ethnic institutions are very, very important determinants of today's economic development. So I've no time to develop my dissent with these kind of papers. Part of this dissent is based on an econometric issues that I'm not going to tackle here. And part of my dissent is also based on conceptual issues. My take is that the emphasis put on pre-colonial ethnic institutions is misplaced, and that ethnicity cannot be taken as a primordial substratum of institutions, if only because it cannot be considered as true that ethnicity was something already settled before the colonial intervention, and if only because ethnicity is in many settings and by far invention or a creation, or at least interacted very much with the colonial intervention. So let's talk a bit of the colonial states. All colonial states relied on precisely on combinations of direct rule by European administrators and indirect rule by the chiefs or African rulers, who accepted those ones who accepted to collaborate with the colonial power and were rewarded for this, were even rewarded with wages. If only because they were employed for collecting taxes on the one hand, and also recruiting military conscripts, at least in the case of French, former French Africa. So even if indirect rule was theorized by the British administrator of Nigeria, Lord Luggett, the French administration also had indirect rule features. So that it's, having studied very much the difference between the two colonizers, whether in terms of educational policies, whether in terms of space management, it's true that there are differences that can be identified, but my take, or what I would say, is that they are pretty much second rank with respect to the global structure of the combination of direct rule and indirect rule that is really a common feature of British, French, and other kinds of colonization in Africa. Now, turning to the post-colonial period, I would characterize the institutional landscape of many African countries by a dual economic and political space, which is probably at the root of many development failures and also of the level of inequality that is observed in present-day Africa. So I gather that with Gary Phil, we'll hear a bit talking about the dualism of the economic space, but I would like to insist on the fact that, from my standpoint, the duality is not only economic in the coexistence of a tiny formal sector and a large informal sector that we largely also talked about with the contribution of Danny Roderick, it's also political. Post-colonial African state can be called, following the word of the historian Frederick Cooper, gatekeeper states, whose resources rely mainly on what Collier called rents of sovereignty, whether they stem from taxation of the exports of a natural resource or agricultural products, or whether they stem from international foreign aid. And those gatekeeper states, where the colonial legacy is of course obvious, remain very small in size and weak in authority. Even if for the recent comparisons with it, for the French colonial empire, the size of the states that was reached at the end of the colonial period, in terms of the weight of the states, in terms, for instance, of expenditures per capita, is very much comparable to the size that is that is prevailing now. So that in sub-Saharan Africa, we can't say that there has been an expansion or an increase of the weight of the size of the state, and it's very much due to the failure of expanding the taxation of the domestic economy. One should not caricature too much the weakness and the lack of authority of these states, because we have shown also that even at the border, in the peripheral areas lying at the border of those states, in the case of Côte d'Ivoire, you had a strong, rather relatively stronger state with large fiscal capacity. The differences, the policies that this state was able to implement make the difference at the borders. Okay, so that you could observe really great discontinuity, for instance, in income or consumption per capita when you were crossing the border, going from the peripheral areas of Côte d'Ivoire, crossing the border towards either Ghana, the eastern neighbor, or towards Mali, the northern neighbor. Okay, so not too much caricature, if possible. So now, of course, the other great actors, these states are weak in the sense that they don't hold the monopoly of many services that are considered to be delivered by state institutions, and not no monopoly over security in many instances, over justice, over social protection, and it's really, really an important feature of the African setting that you have competing non-state institutions that provide this kind of services, which are often linked to what is called ethnicity, but perhaps it could be considered that they are mainly based on lineages and extended lineages. So after the democratization, or after in the 1990s, electoral democracy emerged, progressively spread out the African continent, and it resulted, this competition of non-state institutions resulted into a relatively regionally fragmented political space. What does it mean? It means that the main political parties are usually have a regional base, and they defend the interests of regionally identified supporters, and so that the political platforms that they have do not differ in terms of a left-right scale. They are not pro-poor or pro-rich, but just differentiated, mainly differentiated according to regional line. Still, it's once again, this is a fact, but still, this fact should not be caricatured either, because as it could be shown in the case of Ghana, a country that has known already three political shifts in power, peaceful political shifts in power out of democratic election, of course, it cannot be that the pivotal voter, the voter that decided for the success of one of the two political parties that make the Ghanaian political space, was not an ethnic voter. It was a voter who based his own his vote on the assessment of the incumbent's performance as compared to the opponent's proposals. So, to some extent, when we look at the surveys with regards to ethnic identification in the Afrobarometer surveys that have been implemented following the wave of democratization in Africa, we could wonder to which extent ethnicity as a tool of political mobilization could not be called as a people opium, because I throw that just as a suggestion in the room. Because when we look at the intensity of ethnic identification across the social pyramid, it's pretty much visible that it's in the lower status occupation that ethnic identification is the strongest, whether when you look at the more educated and those who hold formal jobs in the formal sector, the identification is much less intense. So, of course, just to conclude, I'm just hoping that I illustrated a bit what I consider to be two very important research questions, at least with regards to the future economic development of Africa. One is very much related to smallholder agriculture, so I would really care of having more resources for doing a very in-depth research regarding the processes of land allocation, distribution, inheritance within the smallholder African agriculture. There is, of course, the issue, the very, very difficult issue of technology adoption, with perhaps the related issue of the related question that must be raised and asked, and having talked yesterday with Alain de Genvry on this issue, I can safely commit on this question. It's not very clear that ready-made technologies are available for improving very, 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 very greatly the yields or the productivity of African agriculture. So that, to some extent, perhaps it's not only the question of technology adoption assuming that technologies are available, which is also the question of the building of the public goods corresponding to technology that would be able to both increase the yields, not only the yields, but also to save labor. Of course, there is also, with regards to that question, the role of big holders, the role of, an issue that has been very much raised with the so-called land grabbing problem that was raised in the recent years. But if you see the question of the settlement of big agro industries in Africa, perhaps it could be also very much a chance, because it could use very much smallholders as subcontractors to an emerging agro-industrial sector. So with respect to state and non-state, I gather that I already summarized more or less. It's very important from my standpoint to understand now how state and non-state function together and how they jointly determine or undermine the willingness, this joint functioning, the willingness to pay for state services, and to which extent people are more led to redistribute income within the non-state institution rather than to accept further redistribution from an illegitimate state. I gather that I should stop there, but I had research priorities that you can read if you like. Thank you.